Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
Support for WPR comes from the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, an independent organization dedicated to creating experiences that educate, reflect, and inspire. More is at mmoca.org.
Wait, don't quit your job this very minute. Stay with us for some advice on what you should consider before you tell the boss that you are resigning. Coming up on this edition of On Your Money, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Financial planner Kevin McKinley will tell us why more people are quitting their jobs these days and what we should know if we want to follow suit. Plus, more information on donor-advised funds and a consumer alert on vehicle recalls. And as always, answers to your personal finance questions. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
And we have a little bit of feedback, I hear, but we'll try to fix that issue and talk a little bit about this little-known economic statistic that says more people are telling their boss that they are quitting. I almost, Kevin, played that song, Take This Job and You Know What.
Yes, go ahead and offer it to someone else, I think is how that song goes, isn't it?
It is.
Okay. It's called the quit rate, and it refers to people who are voluntarily leaving their job. And according to the most recent numbers from April of 2014, 2% of workers quit their job. That's 2.3 million workers in the month. And that is one of the highest marks since 2009. And it generally shows that the economy is doing well, and it shows that people are confident enough that they can quit one job and move on to another, or they are ready to retire. We saw a number of 3.5% in the leisure and restaurant category of workers, and it was as low as 0.6% for government workers.
So, Kevin, what are the reasons more and more people are leaving their jobs?
Several, depending on their situation. One is with the Affordable Care Act, it's easier to get health insurance on your own. You don't necessarily need to have employer-provided health insurance. You can purchase it on your own. Or, on the flip side of that coin, some people, especially in the leisure and restaurant occupations, may have had their hours cut back because their boss did not want to have employees on with too many hours so that they would have to cover them under the ACA. Several employees, just about everybody, have said that they are being told to do more with less, meaning they need more productivity and their wages aren't rising. And after a while, certain people just say, I can't do any more with less, and I'm either going to stop working or I'm going to find a better job that is asking me to do a little bit less for maybe a little bit more. There are better jobs opening up for people, allowing them to jump to better paying positions or something that provides them with more flexibility. And for retirees who have benefited from a rising asset market, they're probably looking at the balances of their 401ks and saying, you know, I couldn't have retired 5 or 6 years ago on this dollar amount, but now I can, and so I'm going to go ahead and do it.
Well, let's get some advice for all of those categories. What advice do you give to people who are thinking about quitting to jump to another job?
I'm just envisioning right now people listening to this and just doing illegal U-turns on the freeway on the way to work and just turning around and saying, no, I'm not going to go in today or anymore.
Hold on.
don't do it just for the money. Consider the total benefit package. Typically, workers, you know, when they look at pay is typically sometimes as little as 2/3 of the total cost of you working for a particular employer, meaning benefits, health insurance, retirement plan contributions, et cetera, add up to that other 25%. To 30% of the cost of having you as an employee. So make sure that it's not just about the wages, that you're actually getting the money that you want to have come in for this as well. Also, you want to try to have enough savings to cover your expenses for at least 6 to 12 months, even if you have a new job lined up that you're jumping to, because we want you to have an out in case this new job doesn't work out for you as well as you had hoped. And then finally, if you do jump to a new job, many times people are not eligible to begin saving for retirement right away into a 401k because they usually require 6 months or a year's worth of work with the new employer before they're eligible to contribute to the at-work retirement plan. So don't lose out on an opportunity to still save for retirement. Come next April 15th, make sure you open up an IRA or Roth IRA for yourself and your spouse if you're married and he or she is not working outside of the home.
So what about those who are leaving the workforce forever?
Well, go back to our old On Your Money formula. Add up your expenses and see what you can cut. That's helpful as in terms of minimizing that, but also in terms of figuring out where you're at for your overall financial stability and independence. Again, you need to have about 200 times your net monthly expenses in assets. That's adding up your expenses, subtracting Social Security and pension payments on a monthly basis, and then multiplying the remaining figure by 200 to figure out if you have enough money to retire right now. Definitely don't expect future returns to equal your past years the stock market, and you probably want to get a little bit more conservative anyway just because it's easier to make the transition from working and saving and retiring and spending. Consider the healthcare costs, especially if you're not yet eligible for Medicare. You're probably going to spend about $300 to $500 per month per person just for your own health insurance, even if you can qualify for it. Several people in this situation, Joy, look to pay off their mortgage. They say, I don't want to have this debt outstanding and I don't want to have these monthly payments. One of the best ways I can cut my monthly expenses is to pay off my mortgage. And I recommend you do that, but don't do it right away. And in fact, if you find yourself short of cash outside of retirement accounts, you might want to get a new mortgage just to have some extra money available on the side because you won't have an employment anymore on which to base a new mortgage application. So it may be more difficult to get the mortgage. And finally, this is a very illustrative exercise for people who are deciding if they should retire or if they should maybe work one more year. Let's say you're making $60,000 a year, which is a very good income. It's better than the average household income in America. You're thinking, gosh, $60,000, that'd be crazy to give that up. I'm going to just work one more year. $60,000 is a lot of money, but if you divide it out over, say, a 30-year retirement, it works out to about maybe $160 to $170 per month more that you can spend over your retirement than if you were to quit today. And once confronted with that information, especially if you're already financially independent and you have enough money to retire, many times people do say, just take this job and, again, offer it to someone else.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or the services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And it is time now for the On Your Money email bag. A listener says she and her husband are both retired and are considering moving from Wisconsin to North Carolina. However, most of their money is in a tax-sheltered retirement account. And once they sell their old house, they'll still need to get a mortgage to pay for up to half the cost of the new house. And Kevin, she wants to know if they can qualify for a mortgage in their situation.
Well, there's really only one way to find out, and that is to apply. And many people are hesitant if they think they're on the fence about actually qualifying for a loan like this. But you have to remember that the lenders only get paid if the loan gets made, generally. And so they have a financial incentive to actually get you the loan, and most of them will do whatever they possibly can to make sure that you qualify for it. And if you apply at one place and you don't like the answer, go someplace else. Go to a large bank, go to a community bank, go to a credit union, and then if that doesn't work, go to an online place like Quicken Loans, or you can even go to LendingTree or something like that. As long as they have enough assets and they have enough steady income as retirees, they still are likely to qualify for it. And what many lenders do is they say, okay, I see you have a lot of money in a retirement account. Why don't you set up an automatic payment plan of, say, $3,000 a month out of that, and we'll use that as your income to fill in the little box that they need so that you can qualify for a mortgage.
What about her wondering about getting a mortgage for half of the purchase price?
That surprisingly can be a little tricky. Many times lenders say, you know what, we have a minimum amount of debt to equity that we like, and it's actually closer to 60% to 70% usually. And I think in their case, it's actually better if they just do get the old 80-30 rule, get a 30-year mortgage for 80% of the loan to the value, and then if use that cash for emergencies. Sometimes people, when they're buying a new home, they need to spend some money fixing it up or getting it to just to their liking, so that cash can be used for that as well. And then also they can live off of that money, so that many times retirees who do have a significant amount of money in tax-sheltered retirement accounts, they need to start pulling money out for emergencies or just for living expenses that can boost them up above the top of the 15% federal income tax bracket into the 25% bracket. And that can be very expensive. So if they have some of that cash set aside from the mortgage, they can use that money to pay for emergencies or pay for extra expenses. And if they get to the point where they say, you know, we're just building up so much money, we really would like a smaller mortgage, they can always turn around and put that savings back in and pay off the mortgage either right away or pay it off on a more aggressive basis.
And if they can't get a mortgage, what about paying cash for the house by tapping into their retirement accounts?
I'd advise against that, just because that could be a very big tax bill, again, especially if it shoots them up into the 25 or higher percent bracket. If they are going to do that, I'd like to see people in this situation try to pull the payments out over two tax years. So, for instance, let's say they were buying a house in July. They would pull half of what they needed out right now, and then hopefully pull half of what they, the other half of what they needed in like January 2nd or 3rd of 2015. And that would at least spread the tax bite over 2 years, which may lower their bill as well. This is could be a better idea, but it's also something that people have a hard time getting their arms around. You can actually buy a home with a reverse mortgage. And the qualifications for doing so are much less. You can't generally buy something that's above and beyond the amount of equity that you can put into the house. For instance, you can't just get a house for free, but you can get a reverse mortgage for about, oh, maybe a half to two-thirds of the value of the home. And again, that's something they can always pay off as well. But if they do get a reverse mortgage, the interest on the money borrowed will be higher, and the origination fees will generally be higher on that reverse mortgage as well, more so than a traditional mortgage.
And what do you think North Carolina has that Wisconsin doesn't have?
I don't know, but don't let the door hit them on the way out. That's what I say.
Well, yeah. If you have a question for Kevin and would like
Joy, I guarantee they'll miss the winters. Come February when it's, you know, 52 degrees and maybe a little sunny in North Carolina and we're at 52 below wind chill and slipping and sliding on the ice. They'll wish they were back
here. They're going to miss us when they're gone. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Steve in Green Bay has a question for you, Kevin. Hi, Steve.
Hello there. I'll be retiring at the end of August, and I've got a question about paying off my vehicle from my my lump sum, or not paying it off and let that money work in the market, and just pay it off monthly.
You know, so you have a retirement account.
I just wonder which would be the better way.
You have a retirement account, Steve, that is at your employer that you can move into an IRA or, quite frankly, just cash out. Correct.
Right, I'm taking a lump sum and moving over to another traditional IRA with another company, along with the 401k. Yes.
Okay, that's fine. The only what's the balance of the loan roughly?
By that time it'll be about $18,000.
Okay. The problem with doing that is that, again, it could boost you up into a higher tax bracket, and the extra taxes that you pay could be more than the interest that you save. And when you talk about keeping it working, I assume you mean like leaving it invested in mutual funds, in the stock market, et cetera?
Right, yes.
Okay. It's just as likely that it could work against you if you do that, meaning that you're just as likely to see the balance go down, especially in the near term, as you are to see it go up. So if you're going to do that, do you know what the interest rate is on the loan, Steve?
1.9.
Okay. Then I definitely would not pay that loan off at 1.9%. You can find CDs right now, especially longer term, that pay 2%, and I wouldn't do it. If you were in the 8 or 9% range, I'd say, yes, go ahead and do that. But between the extra tax bill and the cost of the low cost of the loan, I would not do it. You might want to, like I said, move the money into a little bit more conservative account just so that you don't give a bunch of it back to the whims of the market. But no, otherwise, I wouldn't pay that off any faster than I have to.
Okay, I thought that way too, but I wanted to hear you say it.
Well, you did. You heard him say it. And good luck and congratulations on your upcoming retirement, Steve. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I want to ease This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. If you have a personal finance question that you would like to run by Kevin, let's go to Dave in Cudahy now. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, my question regards Kevin's formula for with your expenses minus your income being your Social Security and pensions and such, and this pot of liquid assets that's on the side that you draw from, what kind of return should I be getting on that pot of liquid assets, and will it reduce over the years?
That's a good question. You're speaking of not the overall portfolio, but just money that you're keeping set aside for emergencies or for upcoming expenses?
Well, the liquid assets that you say. Okay.
When you
work out your formula, it's 200 times, and this is what you should have on the side in liquid assets.
Correct.
What kind of return should I be getting on that pot of liquid assets?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer because I have no idea what interest rates and investments are going to do in the future. And most of the times, people's investment returns are determined not by anything they do, but why those investments, what those investments do. And to make things last, typically, when I run longer-term scenarios for clients, Dave, what I like to do is use a 3% annualized rate of return and 3% inflation and just try to project out that the money will grow at the same rate that their expenses are growing. And I think that's probably on the conservative side, depending on the time at which you're looking as a beginning date. But it's something that I feel better about. I'd always rather have you err on the side of caution and be pleasantly surprised rather than saying, hey, I'm going to make 10% a year on this account, I can retire today, and then be disappointed when you maybe only make 5%, or worse yet, have a 30 or 40% drop in a particular bad year.
Yeah, and I'm going to ask a question. Dave knows what liquid assets are, and you do, but maybe not everybody does. If you have liquid assets, then they're not tied up in some investment, aren't they easy access liquid assets?
Yeah, that's a good question. Liquid typically is defined as something that's immediately accessible, and assets can be something that's maybe invested more for the longer term, like stocks and stock mutual funds and even bond mutual funds. Liquid assets, at least as I define it, is money market, checking accounts, short-term CDs, short-term treasury, saving bonds, stuff you can not only get at quickly and easily, but also is likely to be at a certain value, meaning it doesn't have a lot of volatility in the in the value on a, say, month-to-month basis.
Yeah. Okay, Dave?
Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much. Let's go to John in Madison next. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Good morning. What's your question?
My question, Kevin, is that I have a 21-year-old niece in Arizona who's taken out about $40,000 in student loans. And I would like to become her favorite uncle and pay those loans off. And, I could do that in 1 year, but I'm wondering if that would be perceived as a gift to her and therefore she would have a tax liability. And so if instead I should say pay off $10,000 a year and then that would be under the gift limit.
Well, that's very generous, and I can pretty much, without knowing her other uncles, I can say that this is a great way to jump up to first place on her list of favorite uncles. So I think
I have a lot of competition.
This is a throwdown right here. This is a nuclear bomb of favorite uncleism. Here's how I would do this. I would do it one of two ways. I would either give her, you can give her $14,000 per year with no gift tax implications and no extra filing. And if you do that, you can actually get it paid out over about 18 months, meaning you'd put $14,000 towards it now, another $14,000 on January 2nd of 2015, and then the final $14,000, give or take, on January 2nd of 2016. And that would allow you, again, it's less than 18 months and still allow you to not run afoul of the gift tax laws. You can also give her the whole $40,000 and pay that off right away. There still would be no gift tax liability, but you do have to file a special form that says, I'm using up some of my millions and millions of dollars of lifetime gift exemption. I think it's Form 709 that you have to file. And that still absolves you and her of any gift tax liability, but allows you to give her the money right away. And do you have a CPA who does your taxes or a tax preparer, John?
No, I do it myself.
Okay. You might be able to handle this on your own. It's a relatively innocuous situation, and it's not like you're trying to avoid any big taxes. So even if you do get called on it down the road, it's you're not trying to dodge something. You're doing something that a lot of people do when they have the resources. They try to help out someone they care about and get on the right feet. Are you going to have her pay you back, or is this going to be a straight gift?
It's going to be a straight gift.
Okay, good for you. No, I would do it one of those two ways, and just give the money to her and make sure she uses it to pay the loans off. And either depends on if you want to spread it out or if you want to file a form when it comes time to do your taxes for 2014.
Thank you so much. You deserve all the praise that you get over the years.
Oh, there we go. Thank you.
That's the most false praise we've ever received.
Thanks, Uncle John. You're the best. Let's go next to Katie it's Kate in Elm Grove. Hi, Kate.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. What is your question?
First, I have to say that I'm a longtime listener, first-time caller, and I listen as much for the wit as I do for the advice.
Oh, I'm sorry.
My question is, my husband is retired, and his company is offering a lump sum as well as various and sundry types of pension amounts, pension payouts. What is your feeling on taking a lump sum versus taking a monthly payout?
Mm. Do you have other assets, Kate, besides this this pension account, or is this a significant portion of what will you live on in retirement?
Well, it's a good portion. It's maybe not quite half.
Okay. If everything goes great for both you and your husband and the pension will probably work out to be a better deal, meaning that you both live a long time and the pension survives for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But if you set the pension payments up on one or both of your life expectancies and you die sooner than you expected, the pension wins. Or what's worse for you is the pension dies before you do. And that's probably more likely to happen simply because many of these pensions, and you can actually check this, many of the pensions use a rate of return projected forward that I don't think is sustainable. I hope it is. But many of them are using 6 and 7 and 8% annual rates of return to say, hey, we're going to always make enough money so that we can always make the payments that we are promising to you. And the problem, of course, is once you take that pension payment, it's very difficult to put the toothpaste back in the tube. You can't go back and say, oh, shoot, I wish we would have taken the lump sum, or we found a better place to spend the money, or we really found a better investment than what this pension can provide. And a good example is, let's say interest rates go to 5% on CDs. That may never happen, but if it did, you'd say, oh, shoot, I wish we could roll this lump sum over into FDIC-insured CDs and collect a much higher interest rate on it. So because I'm conservative to the point of being paranoid, it's actually better for you to roll the lump sum over. And you don't have to invest it even. You can put it in CDs right now and get a couple percent, maybe 3% if you're lucky. But that's actually the safer way to go than to bet on this lifetime of income coming from, quite frankly, from people who really their charge or their higher calling is not going to be protecting your retirement when you're 86 years old. It's going to be protecting the company's assets and the current workers and the current stockholders, rather than trying to pay off people who haven't worked for them for 25 years.
Thanks, Kate, and good luck to you. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Time now for Smart Assets. And a few weeks ago, Kevin, you alluded to donor-advised funds. And a number of listeners have said, tell us more, tell us more. So what's up with donor-advised funds?
Those ones finally won out over those saying, shut up, stop talking. But when is this show over? Donor-advised funds are tax-advantaged mini-foundations, meaning that you put money or assets into this account, this donor advised fund, you get a big tax break now, and then over time, during the subsequent years or even decades, you donate money from the donor advised fund to qualified organizations. You don't get the tax break then. There are about 200,000 donor advised fund accounts in America. They have about $45 billion in assets, and the assets grew 19% in the last year. Part of that was because people are using them more. Also, part of it is because the assets within the donor advised funds grew as well.
So why is now a good time to start looking at donor advised funds?
Right. Most people think about charitable giving and donating in December, but I'd rather have them look at it in July, and the reason being that it gives you time to plan before the end of the tax year, and especially because asset prices are relatively high. If you have stocks or you're in the stock market, especially the United States, many prices are reaching all-time highs. Therefore, many people have appreciated assets with an inherent capital gain. And if they sell them, they'll have to pay taxes on that capital gain. But if they instead donate those shares, more goes to the charity, and they may be able to use the qualifying tax break to then sell other assets that would otherwise incur a big capital gains tax, but they can avoid the tax on that completely. Or they might want to do it and say, well, I'm going to put this money in the donor advised fund, get the tax break, and then I'm going to pull more money out of my IRA, let's say, and not pay any taxes on that because the break I got on the donor advised fund donation.
Oh, so what kind of plan should a would-be donor use?
If you figure out your future giving amount, and let's say you give $5,000 per year to qualified charities, and let's say it's over 10 years. Well, you might want to donate up to $50,000 right now to the donor advised fund. And typically, we like to see that in appreciated assets, but you can just donate cash as well and still get a tax break on it. And then over the next 10 years, give that $5,000 out from the donor advised fund to the qualified organizations you already would be donating to.
Okay, so more information can be found where?
Start with your CPA or your tax preparer, because he or she can tell you not only if you qualify for the tax break, but how much it might save you and give you some analysis on which things would be best to donate. If you have a financial advisor or a major bank, sometimes they'll have people who can help you analyze your portfolio and see which assets it would be most appropriate to put into the donor advised fund. Several big companies like Vanguard, Schwab, and Fidelity have their own donor advised funds that you can use directly. Also, many charities also have their own accounts that they've set up, so if you want to give the money to the charity. And then finally, several community foundations have their own donor advised funds if you want the money to remain in the community. You know, the good and the bad news is it's kind of limited by that, but at least you're putting it towards organizations closer to home. And the community foundation can help you set up your own donor advised fund, do all the paperwork for you and everything like that.
Sounds good. If you would like Kevin to elaborate on a financial issue or investment vehicle, or if you have a personal finance question for him, you can call 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Gary in Merrill is with us now. Hi,
so
Gary.
Yes, hi. A couple questions on an annuity. This would be a life insurance company with a double B rating. And a couple plans. One, you'd get a guaranteed 7%. The other one, you'd get a 10% bonus, and then it would be indexed to the Standard & Poor's, where you wouldn't lose any principal, but you might not make anything for years. And then the other question, they say the guarantee of my principal in a life insurance company is that they have to have the equal amount set aside in some cash, so if they lose my investment, I would be paid off. And just wondering what your thoughts are on something like that.
I'm glad you asked. You've obviously done some homework on this, Gary, but I'm guessing some bright and shiny representative is suggesting this to you as well. This isn't something you sought out on your own, correct?
No, it certainly isn't. So he has a radio program. He comes on, and it sounds almost too good to be true.
Well, that's because it is, especially if you're dealing with an insurance company that has a double B rating. That's a very low rating for an insurance company safety. It sounds pretty good. You know, I would have been happy with that grade point average in college, but in terms of rating insurance companies, that's not very good. There are several out there that you can find that have a much better rating and are much more likely to pay you off. And also another concern I have, and this happens a lot, and this is no reflection on you, these are very confusing vehicles, and sometimes I feel like they're designed that way. You probably have like a 200-page prospectus that you've been given on this investment already, right?
Well, yes, quite a bit of information, yes.
But, okay. Yeah, and I'm not sure. I haven't met the person alive who has actually read that prospectus from cover to cover, be he or she the buyer, the seller, the author, whatever. Nobody ever reads those things. And buried in there are all kinds of little catches and things that make the, like you said, Gary, the vehicle seem too good to be true. You're not going to be getting 7%. There's no way that the insurance company can invest the money and make enough of a profit off to pay all their expenses, which typically run about 3% a year, and then still guarantee you 7%. In fact, the only guaranteed investments out there right now are, in my mind anyway, are treasuries and CDs, and those typically pay anywhere from none percent up to 3.5%. And the 3.5%, you typically have to go out 20 years or so to get that guarantee. There is something to be said for saying, I want to be in the stock market, but I want some kind of insurance that I'm not going to lose everything. Well, I think you could put it in a Vanguard index fund, and you're not going to lose everything. It can go down a lot, but you're not going to lose everything. But if you want to go with this annuity, I would definitely want you to pick one that were more had a safer rating underneath it. They might not offer as high of a guarantee on it, but I'd rather have you go with one that's more likely to pay your principal back. And I would be very, very clear with the agent about how you get this so-called 7%, how you get this so-called 10%, and then what are the downsides? How can you lose money? Do you lose money if you pull it out early before a particular time? Most annuities sold like this have a surrender charge, meaning if you pull the money out in the first or second year, you lose 6 to 10% of it. And that scale typically goes down, but it goes down over 8 or 10 years. So if you decide you don't like the investment anymore, not only could you lose value on it, but you also could lose money according to the surrender charge. So I understand the interest in it, and I appreciate you digging into it as deeply as you have. Generally, the people who have had these things, unless the markets have done really well while they've had them, they've generally been disappointed and wish they wouldn't have, at least in my experience.
Thanks for the call, Gary. Good luck to you. We'll get to more of your calls, and we will issue a consumer alert as On Your Money continues. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. This is the Ideas Network.
Here in my car, I have the safest of all. I can lock all my doors. It's the only way to live in cars.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and we are going to talk about some car recalls that are in the news on a pretty regular basis. But, Kevin, you suspect that we may not be paying close enough attention. Why not?
Well, this is a very serious subject, but really the only reason I wanted to cover today is so I could hear that little word from cars. So.
Right.
Yeah, we have a new record in America right now of the number of cars recalled in a calendar year, almost 40 million vehicles, and we're just 6 months into the year. That beats the record of 33 million vehicles recalled back in 2004. The latest announcement is General Motors, of course, has millions and millions of vehicles that they're bringing back in, but others have been doing the same. Toyota, Nissan, Honda, Mazda, there was an airbag issue with many of their vehicles that they've called back as well. And the National Highway and Transportation Safety Administration says that up to 30% of people who get these recall notices ignore them, and it gets worse for vehicles that are older. For vehicles in 2000, for instance, only 40% of people actually follow the recall. They only pay attention to it and actually take action. So 60% of the people with older vehicles are not paying attention to the recall that has happened with their particular brand and model.
And why should owners pay more attention to these recall notices?
Well, it could cost you a lot of money and more. As I mentioned, the airbag issue, if the airbag either doesn't go off or goes off improperly when you don't want it to, you could become even more injured than you otherwise would. So you want that fixed as well. And you have the opportunity right now under the recall to get the problem fixed for free. And CBS MarketWatch did an article on this a couple days ago, and they quoted a liability lawyer who said, if you miss out on a recall and then you sell your vehicle to someone else and that person gets injured because the fact that the part or the component of the vehicle was not replaced according to your option, you could personally be liable for that as well. And worst of all, this is not just a financial issue, it's a safety issue because there are definitely things that can go wrong that can just be, you know, leave you stuck on the side of the road, but there are the things that could hurt you or others if you don't get them fixed.
Oh, my. So if we don't get a notice, then we're in the clear?
Probably not, just because there are so many millions of these that go out that might have been thrown away. The address that that the issuer has on record for you might be wrong. You might have missed it. You might not have received it. And especially if you are selling your car, you want to have proof that you've gone through all the recalls and you've actually met them. So the buyer asks, he or she has proof that that you did get those recalls. And the same thing if you are going to be buying a car. You want that seller to show that they did all the things that they were supposed to do according to the recall so it doesn't become a problem for you down the road. So definitely check to see if the vehicle had recalls in the past, if you are buying a used vehicle, and more importantly, to see if the seller had it fixed.
So where can we go to check on our vehicle or a particular vehicle?
You can start with your local dealer service department for your particular brand and model, but you can also go to recalls.gov. And they have a complete listing not only of vehicles that have been recalled, but also all kinds of other products. And then you can also, this is something that is a sister site to that one as well, at the National Highway and Transportation Safety Administration.gov, NHTSA.gov. They have a listing of cars that have had consistent problems. I mean, more types of problems of a particular nature than other vehicles or other types of problems, whatever. So again, if you're looking at a particular vehicle, you can see if the one that you're considering has had an abnormal type of problems and then ask the seller if those problems have been fixed and if they've come up at all.
I shall check it out. We are talking about money matters with financial planner Kevin McKinley, and we have time for more of your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Dave in Fond du Lac is with us. Hello, Dave.
Hi. I just had a question. I am 26, and I've finally been able to save a little bit of money, and I've been looking to invest it and have my money work for me at some point, too. And I was just wondering if you could point me in a good direction of places to start or what you would recommend. I've done a little bit of research, but I'm still learning everything here.
What do you, and good for you for doing this, by the way, but what type of goal do you have for this money?
I guess I would hope for it to be like a long-term investment, not necessarily like a retirement plan or anything, whether it be stocks, but an investment to have it pay off in the end, you know, have it make money for me too.
Sure. Do you plan on using it within the next 10 or 20 years, Dave?
I would put a time frame on it of like 15, 20 years. Yeah. So.
Okay. That sounds good. And that's usually a pretty reasonable time frame. It, as long as you're comfortable, when you go for growth, you need to know that it's not only possible, but likely that at some point along that 15 to 20 year timeline, you may have a 30 to 40% drop in the value from 1 year to the next. And that doesn't make it necessarily a bad investment if it does happen to it, but it does mean you have to prepare yourself for it. And especially when we are breaking all-time highs, it's more likely that that will occur in the future than it would if we were breaking all-time lows. And so I'd like you to be very cautious about that. That said, several different fund companies, Vanguard is one of the primary ones, offer target date funds. And what those target date funds do is they start out relatively aggressive now, meaning they have a portfolio mix that's more stock mutual funds and less bond mutual funds and cash. And then as you near a particular year that you can choose, they offer usually in five-year increments, so you could pick one out and say in 2035 in 20 years from now. And as it gets closer to 2035, that allocation would automatically become more conservative for you. So it doesn't mean you can't lose money. You still can drop in value, but it won't drop as much in 20 years as it might drop today. And that's okay because you have already said you don't need the money. So Vanguard offered those, but so do a lot of other companies out there. Vanguard just is one of the cheapest.
Okay, Dave?
Gotcha. Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Ron in Thiensville. I'm sorry. It's Thiensville. Go ahead, Ron.
Thiensville. Hi. Good morning, Kevin and Joy. Kevin, my question is, what is the best strategy or way for married couples to have their assets listed in? I'm specifically talking about the names on accounts, or should the... Should you have some counts separate, or should you have them all joint, or what is the best strategy?
I get this question a lot, and usually I get it because people come to me in my grown-up job, and they apologize to me by the way that they handle their money or title it as a couple. And there are no apologies necessary as long as it's legal and it works for you. And most couples need to figure that out in a way that's right for them rather than saying what is the standard way to do it. On the other hand, if you have things set up separately, a couple problems that can arise are when one of you is incapacitated but alive and needs to make decisions or needs to withdraw money from the account unless you have someone else on as an interested party or have legal documents in place so that the person can withdraw the money. It might be difficult to get it out if not impossible. So I would make sure to have the person on the account if you would. Typically what you see these days is joint tenancy with rights of survivorship, and that means that for a couple, they both have an interest in the account, and the money automatically goes to the survivor if one member of the couple should pass away, and that's the standard amount. The or and thing, you only see that usually at banks, and many banks and credit unions don't use that anymore as a designation. It's a little antiquated, but I would check with each institution you work with. Tell them what you want. You might say, hey, I just want this money for myself and I don't want my spouse to have any access to it. That's legal while you're still married, and you can say that. But you may also want to say, hey, I just want to keep this in my own name. But if something happens to me, I want my spouse to be able to withdraw the money, check the balance, do whatever they need to do with the account. How would I go about that without putting the person on the account as an owner? And just go to each institution, because every institution has their own specific way of handling that and titling these accounts. And if you find an institution that works best for you, you may want to consolidate those if you're having a difficulty with all the different accounts spread all around.
How about I hear some folks have things in trusts, their assets in a trust.
Mm-hmm. That can be a good idea. It solves some of the ownership issues. Again, if you're incapacitated, it creates kind of a legal entity to take over ownership and management of it. It's not completely necessary, but it is a good idea if you want to try to avoid probate. You still can have probate even if you do have a trust, but it provides a conduit, if you will, to how assets should be transferred from where they're at now to where you want them to be. Again, if you're not able or
4 year passed away, if you're not able to handle the money yourself. And it's a good idea to do that, not only with a lawyer who knows what he or she is doing on these, but also to do it now while you are in a reasonable, sound mind and body, and can make those decisions on paper first before you have to do it in an emergency.
Thanks, Ron. Next, we go to Vicki in Prentice. Hello, Vicki.
Good morning. First, I want to thank the amazing and smart Kevin and Joy for taking my question, even though my praise can't compete with Uncle John this morning. But my quick question is, Kevin, you often refer to married couples. If your income is below $72,000, you'll pay that lower percentage for income tax. And I just want to clear up, if you make above the $72,000 and pay the higher income tax rate, is that only on the dollars above the $72,000? Do you still pay the $15,000 on the first $72,000, the 15% on the first $72,000, and then is it like 25% on the money above that?
Yeah, you're correct, and thank you for your kind words. A federal income tax bracket is progressive, meaning that the rate goes up as your income goes up, but it is only on the income above a certain level. And the number to which you are referring is, do we need it on line 43 of the 1040? And for married couples filing jointly in 2014, I think it's $73,360 on that line 43. Anything below that amount is taxed at 15% or less. If you make $10,000 or $20,000 a year, you generally pay no income taxes. Anything above that dollar amount, the $73,000, et cetera, is taxed at 25%. And then it goes up to, I think, about $130,000 or something. And then that bumps up to $28,000 and $30,000 and $33,000, et cetera, all the way up. But no, that's a really important number, because most middle class, especially two-income families, are around that number at some point if they have full-time jobs. And as they get closer to that, it's very important that they know about it, because if they're paying more taxes than they should or than they'd prefer, it's usually because they've crossed over into that bracket.
Vicki gets a follow-up because she included me in the false praise. Vicki, do you have a follow-up?
No, that was very helpful. Thank you both so much.
Thanks a lot for the call. I'm going to get Mike and Minong in. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Good show as always. Kevin, I have a question about rolling over some sabbatical leave. As I see it, I have two options. I can stay on the payroll for about 7 months until my retirement date, or I can work through my retirement date and take that sabbatical payout and actually roll it into a deferred compensation program.
Mm-hmm.
Would I just be subject to the Social Security and Medicare tax then?
I'm not sure on that. It depends on how the employer defines the pay. I would check with them and see what they say on it. Social Security and Medicare tax, by the way, Social Security tax is not necessarily a bad thing, because Social Security tax is one of the most immediate paybacks that you get, because the more Social Security tax that you pay over your lifetime, generally the higher your benefits. So that part about it, I wouldn't be as concerned about it. I'd be more concerned, Mike, do you want to keep working for the job? Do you enjoy it?
Oh, sure, absolutely. But I would rather, you know, seek to draw that money out as a benefit on the deferred compensation program, you know, over time.
Absolutely.
Rather than just use it as a payroll extender, you know, for 6 or 7 months of work. So.
Absolutely. No, and I would recommend that you do that, because once you roll it over, then, you know, you can pull it out as you see fit and manage the income so that your taxes are on it as little as possible. So as long as you're comfortable with that and the employer lets you do that, I wouldn't even be concerned about the Social Security and Medicare part of it. I'm sure that you'd save more of it by being able to pull it out at your discretion once you retire.
Thanks very much, Mike. Good luck to you. Well, Kevin, let's talk about the website of the week now.
Yeah, we've been discussing a lot about the cost of college, student loans, et cetera. There's a great website that that the government has called collegecost.ed.gov, collegecost.ed.gov. And what that allows you to do is to families and students can look at any school in the country and see not only what the graduation rate is of the people who attend the school, how many of them have to take out student loans, what the average student loan balance is, et cetera, all kinds of different metrics that give you an idea of what kind of predicament you're getting into if you might choose a particular your school. Again, collegecost.ed.gov, and we'll have this website up along with all the other websites that we've mentioned today at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Well, another fun and informative show, Kevin. Should we do this again next week?
Okay,
sure. All right. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Financial planner Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and Kevin is with us just about every week at this time. We are live on Tuesday mornings, rebroadcast on Tuesday evenings, and rebroadcast again on Sunday mornings. Thanks to my producers, Christy Taylor, Bill Martins, Justin Williams, and Robin Cherry. And thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.